I went to the new San Francisco Museum of Modern Art the other night, and you know, it's a beast of a museum. It's freaking huge, and you know, I'm walking around in it, and you know, I'm seeing you know, art that I love, but that I know. You know, there's a whole bunch of Richters, and it was great to see these Richters. I'd seen them before. But it was great to see them again and in person, in the flesh. You know, they have a small, considerable room with a few Calder mobiles in them. And, you know, I've seen these mobiles a million times, but it was really nice to see them. They had some space to breathe. They were this very elegant, very well-chosen set of mobiles. And so I'm walking around this sort of vast museum, and I'm feeling and thinking a whole variety of things. You know, on the one hand, it's great to see these things. It's just awesome, right? I mean, those Calders are great. Those Richters are great. The Gerskys, you know, I don't know how many Frank Stellas I need to see, but, you know, it's just nice to see these things in person and have the opportunity, basically, more or less anytime I want, pop in and see one. On the other hand, you know, come on, man. Like, what they did is take this art that was kind of dangerous at one point and really domesticate it. And it, you know, while it's great to see these things, I want to see new things. I want to be blown away now. You know, I want the contemporary art scene to prosper. And I wish this museum, with all its money, could put some towards, you know, emerging artists. You know, there's a lot of great art out there. And then there's this building, right? And on the one hand, it's huge, and it's something just ostentatious, you know, especially in the context of San Francisco, where wealth is so conspicuous and the consumption is so conspicuous, it's a tad repulsive. And this museum just seems, you know, absurd. And, you know, from the outside, you know, the old museum was so ugly and they kept it, and now they've added something even uglier behind it. But inside, there's a lot of nice spaces, right? It's sort of labyrinthine. You don't always know where you are. There's some dark stairwells. And there's something just kind of nice about being in this weird space that feels bizarre and monumental at the same time labyrinthine. My point is not to talk about SFMOMA. My point is that we feel no... and experience a multiplicity of things, right, at all times. I can't just simply reduce, you know, the museum to this or that, to just bad or just good. There are things I like, there are things I don't like, and they all work together in this kind of conjunction, and then hopefully when it's really open to the public for good, I can find my way with it or decide not to go or decide to go sometimes. I don't have to have a monolithic opinion, just as a thing is never monolithic, right? There's always this multiplicity of perspectives on something. You know, you're on Facebook, and this becomes really so apparent. If you see this, some event happens, let's say the Beyonce video. I know she has something new called Lemonade, but I'm thinking of something else about New Orleans and Katrina and there are people who love this thing. They're like, oh, look at this great vision of empowerment, this piercing, you know, insights or critiques of race. And then I read something else. It's like, no, this is horrible. How, you know, she's in makeup and high fashion, you know, coming out of the floods of New Orleans. How despicable, how wrong. And she's just trying to sell her records, and it's exploitive. And all I think when I read these, you know, different perspectives is, well, it's both and more, right? I agree with all the opinions. I disagree with all the opinions. I see them all. And this is true of all things, because all things are multiple, right? There is no clear essence to something. A thing is always assembling itself. It has all these different parts and pieces and ways of going together. And the way we make sense of them should celebrate this multiplicity, should celebrate the complexity of all these things. things. You know, all things, you know, are multiple, and our feelings are multiple. There's no reason to try to solidify them into one thing. You know, I think back, you know, my past and the music I listened to growing up. You know, I listened to a lot of classic rock, and I was a big Jethro Tull fan. And I don't have to dismiss that now. You know, that is it. Was it limiting? You know, was I a little adamant at the time? Was I a little late to things like the Pixies and the Smiths and punk rock? Sure. But I also was deeply enmeshed in Zeppelin and Floyd and Tull, and you know, I loved it, and I was passionate. Those things are great. They're great. And my experience of them was great. I don't have to just condemn them or defend them. I can feel multiple things about them. You know, this will probably end up indicting me, you know, but I think about the police, and no doubt, you know, there's a certain, you know, you read about the police, you see things they do, and they're terrifying, right? And then, and it's horrific, and they're always agents of a state, and they're agents of property, and the property elite, and right, I mean, that's why they arrest people who steal things, right? Why don't they defend the people who are stealing things from the rich? Right, from the landed, from the owners. But no, they work for the owners. The laws work for the owners. That's how you know the game is rigged from the get-go. And so in some sense, police are necessarily, you know, wrong. You know, necessarily these agents of the state. And yet, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm walking late at night and, you know, through, I don't know what to call, you know, sort of complex neighborhoods, I'll say, and you know, I'll see a cop go by, and you know, I'm a little relieved. I feel a little, I'm not scared of that cop, and of course, that's because you know, I'm white and I'm middle class, and I don't have to worry about them, but then I don't, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? I can feel these multiple things, right? It's because the agenda and the reality, you know, don't coincide one-to-one. You know, I can have my belief and my adamance in a belief doesn't always coincide with the experience of what I'm feeling and the experience of things that I experience, you know, every day. You know, the everyday is temporal. The agenda is fixed. But things happen. Things exist in, of, and as time, meaning they are always changing and always grabbing on to different elements of the world. You know, each thing in its happening takes different pieces of different things. I mean, just think about myself as I spend time with this person. I take on some of their habits, some of their turns of phrase, some of their likes, some of their dislikes. You know, I watch a movie and I take on a little bit of a character. That's true of all things, right? They exist in time and their status changes over time. I mean, just look at, again, at the SF MoMA example, and modern art and, you know, Pollock, who was so radical at the time, and now it's become almost cliche. And of course, it's not. Pollock supersedes the cliche, but from one perspective, it's already known, right? And therefore, is a kind of cliche. Things change; they change in their relationships to you. You change in relationship to it. It changes in its relationship to the world, right? So everything's changing all the time, and therefore, I suppose everything is multiple. Everything's multiple, therefore, changing all the time. How do we stand towards things? How do we speak about things? You know, I was talking about the Facebook feed, you know, and I see all these different opinions on things, and no matter what it is, there's always another take on it. There's always another take, and I love it. I love seeing all the takes. But of course, if I were to speak to certain of those people who are posting these very adamant beliefs, I might become questionable to them, right? Because I'm with them, but I'm also, I get the other thing too. I see all these different views. And at some point, what I want from the world, from people around me for sure, but really from the world, is this, this way of speaking, this will to multiplicity, this, yes, things are multiple, and therefore I'm not adamant, right? I don't believe one thing. I believe many things. And so when people speak, I'm willing to listen and hear and attempt a kind of empathy or a sympathy or form a relationship to it that's not simply a yes or a no, but is a multiple reckoning of a multiplicity. What I'm trying to suggest, I think, is that there is an ethics, right? An ethics in the multiplicity of things. That once we accept or know or believe or experience the multiplicity of the world, the temporality of the world, the endless morphing and distribution of the world, the metabolic tendencies of the world, the way different things take in different pieces and play them back, it yields a different kind of ethics and a different model of language, a different model of critique, a different model of what it is to make sense of the world. Right? If I believe, if I know that, and I come to the world saying, I am multiple and it is multiple, I will seek a different kind of way of making sense of things. I will seek that multiplicity. I will no longer strive to be definitive or adamant. I will no longer say, this is what Wes Anderson is all about. I'll say, well, he's about this, he's about that. You know, people think he's a little too twee. I see that, but I love these other things also. And it's not that I won't make judgments or pass over certain things or not become passionate about things. On the contrary, it's just that my judgment will become less about saying no to something than simply ignoring it. You know, things I don't like or don't enjoy or don't feel good with, I pass by, right? At some point, you know, SF MoMA, I'll try to find my way with it. I look forward to trying to find my way with it. And if it doesn't become for me, then I just won't go. I don't have to be part of that. This also doesn't mean sometimes I won't have an ardent opinion about it. And I can have that ardent opinion. And I can also be passionate about the multiplicity of things. And in fact, you know, in the multiplicity and experiencing the multiplicity of things is a kind of passion because it's an aliveness to the becoming of things. Right? A critique that seeks multiplicity is a critique that is lively and attentive to the way of things. How does one speak multiply, right? How can one articulate the multiplicity of life just in one's language? You know, I come back to irony, right? Which is speaking at least in two voices, right? It's proffering something and proffering something else. The two need not just efface each other, but be in a kind of cycle, right? A kind of play. So, you know, irony really comes from Socrates and from his belief that all this world gives way to another world. That no matter what you say in this world, it will never suffice. It will never articulate the infinity, right, of being. And he, you know, he distinguishes between becoming and being, and, you know, being the eternal forms, the truth. But irony is this way to kind of speak both, to speak in the world of becoming, but to efface it and point to and conjure the world of being, the infinite. But humor is another way. You know, I think of, you know, Monty Python, of course, right? Now for something completely different. Or, you know, the parrot sketch, you know, the guy goes to return the parody box, it's not making any sound, it's dead. And the shopkeeper just is like, no, it's not. And what's hilarious, again, is what we think of as uniform is suddenly distributed and is suddenly made open and multiple, right? You know, we're confronted with something that doesn't fit the scheme, right? You're a shop owner, you sold me a dead parrot, my parrot's dead. He says, no, it's not. It's just very quiet. And so all your assumptions and all your truths are suddenly, you know, belied, right? Or not recognized. And you laugh, right? It's humor. It's breaking down the categories. Louis C.K. does a similar thing all the time, right? I remember his infamous cold open to SNL, right? His monologue. He goes on this whole thing about pedophiles, you know, and he's like, they must really like it, right? I mean, he's like, I really love a Mounds bar, but if I ate a Mounds bar and they treated me the way they treat pedophiles, I would stop eating a Mounds bar. What's great about that Louis C.K. example is that he's not eliminating moral judgment, right? He can see the multiplicity of perspectives. He can understand that there is a desire that a pedophile has. Doesn't mean that he honors it. Doesn't mean that he thinks it should happen. He can still pass moral judgment and see the multiplicity of perspectives. That to me is the brilliance of humor. In that it will stake a position, but also stakes a relationship between things and embraces the multiplicity of things, right? So humor and irony are ways to speak multiply. You know, there's other ways. You know, I think of Clarice Lispector's great little book, Agua Viva, The Stream of Life, which just proliferates these images, these words, this flow of affect. And the way she achieves this multiplicity is not really through humor or irony, but through a kind of perpetual sliding. She'll juxtapose things, jam them up against each other, and keep moving through them, making different kinds of sense. So if the surrealists were really interested in breaking down categories by jamming two together, you know, the umbrella on the operating table, what Clarice does is keep moving through different senses, and she'll disrupt and break the flow, and breaks down the flow of narrative, breaks down the flow of character. So she initiates another kind of speaking multiply. You know, Joyce, of course, does it, and you know, basically all his books, right? And Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake. So there, you know, it's this will to speak multiply, to try to speak multiply, to try to make language open up, that rather than assuming language needs to say one thing, capture one thing, come up with its hard and fast thesis and solidify things, the trick is to make language open, to multiply, right? I mean, this is what Derrida was loved to do, what Deleuze and Guattari do in a different way in Thousand Plateaus. But just to open it up and not let it just come to one meaning, but to play on the multiplicity of meanings. And, you know, I mean, that was the Derridean thing. What Deleuze and Guattari do is introduce all kinds of terms. They make up concepts. They make up figures. They jam things you wouldn't think of together, you know, geology and ornithology and philosophy and biology, and come up with all kinds of different figures by putting things together that you wouldn't normally put together, right? Things that are in their own place, they suddenly open up. You begin to see the multiple tendrils, right? The multiplicity that streams out. You know, Derrida would do this just with the word difference, right? And just keep playing on deferral, difference, differentiation, and find all these different possibilities of language within language, within language's will to perhaps stop the play and the multiplicity. You know, the great writers really open up language. But this involves, you know, a fundamentally different approach, you know, and really coming at things from a different perspective and a different critical perspective. So, you know, when I was teaching, if students were too univocal in their writing, you know, I push them to open up to see other perspectives, that you don't need to just say this is the way it is. You don't need to be right. You just need to proffer a possibility and show the multiplicity, right? Imagine criticism. Imagine language. Imagine everybody talking as if everything were multiple and there were multiple perspectives. It's not to abandon judgment and morality to see multiplicity, but to see multiplicity is to infuse the ethical sphere with a vitality and finally a respect for the way things go, for the multiple way that things go.